Good morning, Light Point. It's good to be with you here today on this rainy day, but we're really excited to have you here. My name is Lee. If we have not had the chance to meet yet, I'm the teaching pastor here at Light Point, Plain City, and we are nearing the end. Last week, I said we're rounding second. We're heading to third base as we're finishing up our series, Vice and Virtue, where we've kind of been exploring what historically has been known as the seven deadly sins. Sounds exhilarating and exciting. All right, let's look at these deadly sins. Really, it's not that these are the only sins that are deadly. The Bible tells us that any sin and all sin really brings about death and destruction in our lives. But these seven in particular seem to be ones that can creep up on us. They are deceptive. Sometimes we're not aware of them at the times, and so they kind of mask themselves around us, and they're also very destructive because they tend to lead to more destructive behavior in our lives. So we've looked at things like lust and greed. We've looked at things like anger envy and pride, and so today we're going to talk about sloth. I don't know about you, I've never sat in a message in a church about being slothful, and so we're going to hit that here today. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But before we jump into that, I just wanted to give you a quick little renovation update. If you have been around Light Point for a while, you may have noticed when you came in this morning that the lobby looked a little bit different, and so that is by design. If this is your first time with us, it just looks like Light Point to you, so this isn't too much of a change for you. But one of the things that we are doing is we are nearing the end of finishing up the renovation on the new space there. Our hope and our prayer is that it is ready and open for Easter Sunday, and so that is what we're working towards to do that. And so a lot of the work will hopefully be finished up this week, and so we're excited about the progress that is happening over there. But to catch you up to speed, the renovation over there is really to make space for the next generation, for our kids and our students. There's been a huge need because if you've got kids and you've taken them down that hallway, it can get pretty crowded and pretty crazy at times. So just provide some more space, not just for our current families, but really more importantly, for the families that we know God is going to continue to bring here to Life Point. Every week it feels like we're meeting somebody new who's checking out Life Point for the first time. And so we want to just continue to make room for the next generation, as well as for our students to meet on Sunday night so they can have a better space for them to be able to take over and utilize, as well as some other, you know, classrooms and Imago Day sensory room for our special needs kids. And so that'll all be over there. So we're excited for that. But what that means is some things are going to change in the lobby area. One is we're going to readjust and move where our kids' check-in process is. So you may have heard today as you were checking your kids in that we're going to move that really to the wall when you walk into the lobby straight ahead. Part of that reason is to provide a little bit more, to make it easier. If you are new and you're walking in and you've got kids, where to go, you can just see it. It's right in front of you rather than having to go around a corner. But also just a better flow for the system and for kind of where we'll have littles and juniors will stay in the current hallway. So that's birth all the way up through preschool. And then our crew, kindergarten through fifth grade, once they're checked in, we'll head over to the hub is kind of what we're calling that space, hub of activity, hub of ministry, just is more succinct and sounds better than multi-purpose room. So we're going to call that area over there the hub. And so kids check-in will be right in the wall when you come in. Our coffee will move from that corner, and we'll move it to where the current kids check-in area is there. And so that way there'll be some space to still get your fixins and your coffee and tea and those kinds of things along that way. And so, yeah, so that'll start to look different in terms of the check-in stuff will happen next Sunday. You'll see that. That'll be there, and that'll be ready. And then we're hoping to be able to open up the hub and utilize that space on Easter Sunday. And so I'll hopefully be able to give you some really good news next Sunday that is what we're going to do. And so it depends on how much work we get done and finished up this week. So we're going to get after it with that. So that's kind of just a little update on where we're at. And just so you're not surprised next Sunday with where am I checking my kids in and all that kind of stuff. So as we jump back into this series, Vice and Virtue, what we've been talking about every week is that every temptation is an opportunity for faithfulness. And so when you think about temptation, right, it's these fork in the road kind of moments, right, where we're feeling tempted around a decision that we should make. And usually when it comes to temptation, we think about it's a decision to fail. It's a decision to give in to the temptation and to choose maybe what we would be talking about, the vices. And so we, you know, giving into anger, giving into lust, or giving into greed, or giving into envy, those kinds of things. Whereas we wanted to kind of reframe that and say, really, when we experience temptation, it's an opportunity for you and I to choose faithfulness, to pursue a virtue, that temptation inside you and me is pointing to a desire that we have. And so how do we take that desire and choose what's good rather than choose something that might bring about some further destruction and brokenness in our lives? So each week we've kind of contrasted the vice with a virtue. And so as we talk about sloth today, we're going to contrast that with the virtue of being a steward. And you would say, how are those connected? Well, one of the things that we're going to see here is slothfulness isn't just a lack of activity. Slothfulness isn't just somebody who sits on the couch and watches TV and, you know, eats takeout food all day long. That's not really the sloth. Now, can that be a sloth? Absolutely. But it's really much broader than that. So we'll get into that here in just a moment. But as I thought about this idea of sloth and expectations and what that might look like, I kind of was taken back to a time for Michelle and I early on in our marriage, either when we had little kids when they were younger or we were just married. Michelle had more opportunities to really go and hang out with some ladies or to go out for some overnights. And so it just happened a little bit more often than it does now. Probably after this message, she's going to say, hey, Lee, how about we get one of those overnight or one of those kind of times for me to go away on vacation? I'd be like, yep, you deserve that. Anyways, so, but what would happen is she would go away or she would go and see a friend, you know, from college or would go out to dinner. And I would either put the kids, you know, if we had little ones at that time, so, you know, get them fed, get them put away in bed and all that kind of stuff. And so, but for me, here's what I would do. I would just kind of look at that as an opportunity for me to relax. I'd be like, I can watch whatever I want to watch. I can play games. I can watch a show. I could do whatever I wanted to do. Take my sweet old time. And then Michelle would inevitably come home from her trip or from dinner, and then she would see the house is still a mess. She's like, the dishes aren't done, clothes aren't put away, it's still a mess around here. And I'm like, well, I thought my job was to make sure the kids were alive and asleep and that they were fed. I didn't realize all the other stuff that came with it. And so there was all these expectations that now I was becoming confronted with that, oh, okay, so she expects whenever she goes away, she comes home that the house is put together, right? That clothes are put away, pillows are where they're supposed to be on the couch, right? That dishes are done, that the house looks organized and, you know, tidy and well-kept. Because she's like, that's what I do when we have kids, and like that just happens. And so I began to feel like, okay, how then can I show my wife love when she goes on these things? Is right to take care of the house there. Now, I heard someone say once, his name's Dr. John Deloney. He's a kind of a counselor, a psychiatrist, that kind of thing. And he said, our behavior is a language. And so what he was saying is that our behavior, our actions communicate something. Okay? And so as I take that and I think about what were my actions, my behavior, what was it communicating? What language was Michelle receiving from me whenever she would come home and, you know, the house was a mess, was, I don't care about you, right? She was hearing that, right? I was being selfish and not considering and thinking about what would communicate love and care for her. Because then she's like, now we've got work to do. I just want to come home and rest and relax, right? And so how do I serve her by helping getting those things ready? So it was a good wake-up moment for me. So I'm much better about that now. But my behavior was communicating something to her. And so as we look at slothfulness and stewardship, we're not just looking at kind of the behavior, but really what's more important is what is that communicating? And so when we talk about being slothful, it's not just a lack of activity or a lack of effort, but it's what is that lack of effort communicating to someone else? And that's really at the heart of what Jesus is going to address here, and we're going to jump to Matthew 25 here in just a moment. He's going to kind of help show us that really when it comes to our actions and our behavior, it's really a heart problem. It's a motivation problem, right? Because God isn't just mostly concerned with what we do, but more importantly, he's concerned with why we do those things. What's the reason behind that? What's motivating us to do things, and what's motivating us when we don't do things? And that's really at the heart of what we're going after when it comes to slothfulness. And we'll see the contrast of what does it mean to be a steward and how really what that communicates. And so to kind of really summarize where we're going today, the big idea is that our efforts reveal our affections. That our efforts reveal our affections. It's kind of another way to say that the things that you and I do, the effort we put into things reveals our affections about those things, or our affections towards that which those things are connected to. So our efforts reveal our affections. Our behavior communicates something. And so as we look at slothfulness, what is those efforts or lack of effort, what are those things communicating? What affections is that revealing? And that's really what we want to get at to the heart here of Matthew 25. So if you've got a Bible, you can flip it open to the New Testament or turn on your phone or screen and flip there. We'll also have the verses on the screen. But we're going to get to Matthew 25. It's nearing the end of Jesus's ministry here on earth. And one of the things that he is doing is he's trying to help prepare his disciples for the inevitable of when he leaves. And so he's going to, you know, go to the cross, he's going to die, and then he's going to come back to life, and then he's going to eventually ascend and go back to God the Father in heaven, and then one day he will come back. So he's trying to help communicate rightful expectations for his disciples. And so he uses this parable to do that. Now, a parable was a way that Jesus taught, and it was where he would take an earthly story and try to communicate a heavenly meaning with it. And so talking about the kingdom of God or talking about theological concepts can sometimes be really hard to comprehend. And so to try to help make that a little easier to comprehend, Jesus would take things like, you know, farming, or take things like we're going to see here today around like a people who were entrusted resources, and try to communicate something spiritual, something significant from that. So that's really what we're going to see. So as we're looking and reading through this parable, we need to ask ourselves as we're going through it, what heavenly meaning is Jesus trying to communicate to his disciples? What heavenly meaning is he trying to communicate to us? Because the good thing about the Bible is it wasn't just written for this people, this original audience, but it was also meant for you and I here today as well. And so what do we begin to take from this? And so as we look at and we see how our efforts reveal our affections, let's go ahead and see how that plays out here in Matthew chapter 25, starting in verse 14. Jesus says, for it will be, so he's talking about the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, so that's what he says, for it. So God's kingdom and his values and his ways, it's going to be like a man who's going on a journey, who called his servants and entrusted to them his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, to each according to his ability. Then he went away. Now remember, what's going on in Jesus in this time, right? He's preparing, right, to go to the cross and to go back to heaven. So he's on a journey, right? He's doing something, and then he's going to go away for a while. So you see how he's trying to help connect these dots for the disciples here. And so he takes, and it says that he calls them together, and he entrusts to them his property. And so the master here, we got to see, who does the master represent in this parable? Well, it represents God. It represents Jesus here, that he is the one in charge and controlling everything. And then who are the servants? Well, they're God's people. They're the ones who are saying, I am following after Jesus. I am one of God's people. I'm a part of him. And so for us today, it would be like followers of Jesus. And so he has entrusted to us and to these servants his property. So here's some certain categories that are helpful for you and I. I talked a little bit about this last week. And so we can look at our resources, our time, our talents, like our gifts and our abilities, and our treasures, our financial capital, our resources there. We can view them in 2 different ways. We can view them with an owner's mentality or a steward's mentality. And so here's the difference between those. An owner sees their resources as primarily theirs. They're mine. I own them. I've worked for them. I've allotted them. I've earned these types of things. So I would like to do with my money and my time and my resources what I want to do with it. I deserve that. I should be able to do that. They are mine. I have them. And so that's kind of an owner's mentality towards their time and their talents and their treasures. And then a steward sees their resources not as theirs, but as things that have been entrusted and given to them to steward. And so what that means is it would be like if I gave you $1,000 of my own personal money and said, hey, I would love for you to utilize these resources, these financial resources in a way, right, that would honor me. So, you know, don't go blow it on, you know, ESPN bet on the national championship tomorrow night, right, and try to see who's going to shoot and make what. Like, that wouldn't be a wise use of those resources, because you're thinking at the end, I'm going to ask for those resources back because they're ultimately not yours. They're mine, but I'm entrusting them to you. I'm going to go away, and when I come back, I want to receive those things back, and I want to see how you've managed those things. So a steward sees their time, sees their talents, sees their treasures as things given to them to then leverage and use to honor their master, the one who ultimately entrusted those things to them. And so what Jesus is trying to help his disciples and help you and I see is we have to change the way we view those things in our lives. How we look at your talents, your gifts, and your abilities, right? That they're not just your own, right? But actually, God has given you those things. And you would say, well, Lee, well, I studied really hard so I could, you know, get this grade and go to this school and be able to do this job. And I would say, I have no doubt that you worked really hard, but who gave you the mind to process that information? Who put you at a certain point in human history so that you could accumulate the kind of knowledge and have the opportunities that you had? Who helped provide maybe the family and dynamics that you grew up in to be a part of that, to provide those kinds of opportunities? Who gave favor to you towards those admission counselors or towards that employer or towards that opening to do those things? So really, it starts to change how we see these things in our lives, that they're not just our own that we create, but ultimately trying to see them as things that God's entrusted to you and I. Because when we start to change our thinking about those things, now that can begin to change how we relate to them, how we behave, and what we do with those things. That we would take more of a steward's mentality towards those things in our lives. And here's the other thing that happened in these verses, is you see that the master entrusts 5, 2, and 1 talent. Talent was just a sum of money. It was a pretty significant portion of money, right? But he entrusted them, but it says to each to their own ability. And here's why that's important for you and I, is he doesn't just give everyone the same thing. Because not everyone is created equal. Yes, we're all equal in terms of value, dignity, and worth before God, but we all have different abilities. We all have different gifts. We all have different capacities. We all have different things that we're able to do. We're not all the same. We're unique, and we're different. So to help think about this, what that should do for you and I is it should communicate value to you and me. That God sees the way that he made you, that he wants to entrust things to you that you could faithfully steward, right? He's not going to put things on top of you that he doesn't have confidence that you could manage through him, that you could utilize, that you could be faithful towards those things. It should communicate value towards how he sees you. Because think about this for an example here. If we had, like, my kids love Pokemon cards, or you think of trading cards that are out there. And so if you've got a card, and there are 1 million of those cards, and you have one of those cards, it's not all that unique, right? Because there's a lot of them, the same card. And so it's not that valuable because there's a lot like it, okay? But let's say you run across something that there's only one of. If there's a card that is unique, that there's no other card like this card, well, now it becomes a bit more valuable. Recently, I heard about a trading card that sold for a record amount of money. And so let me show you. You may have heard of Caitlin Clark. She's a female basketball player. She took the college basketball this time of year by storm the last couple of years. Now she plays in the WNBA. Last year was her rookie season. So this is Caitlin Clark's rookie card that is a prism that has gold vinyl around it that is autographed. And it is one of one card. There was no other card like this card, which is why somebody paid $366,000 for that card. That's a lot of money, right? I'm not going to tell you what LeBron James's, you know, rookie card went for. It was a little more than $366,000. But what makes these valuable is there's only one of them. You see, you are the only you that God made. God didn't make multiple of you. He made you the way he made you, with the intellect, with the passions, with the abilities, with the opportunities, with the time and place in which we exist. He made you intentionally and purposefully. There's one of you that you've made. So what that means is you can look at your gifts and your abilities, and rather than looking at people around you and saying, I wish that I had what they had, you can see what God has actually entrusted to you. And your measure of success in life isn't what somebody else does, because they aren't you. They don't have what has been given to you. So success for you is looking at what have you been entrusted with and how do you faithfully steward that with your family, with your education, with your finances, with your skills. What do you have and how do you cultivate those and how do you use those? Not what somebody else does, but how do you do that? Because here's what that does. It shifts our mindset because it takes us from being someone who sees our resources as we are makers of our own resources to where we are managers of the resources God has entrusted to us. So let's see what these servants do with these resources. Look with me in verse 16. He who had received the five talents went at once and traded with them, and he made five more talents. So also he who had the two talents made two more talents. But he who had received the one talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. So we see some different responses here to how these servants react with what's been given to them, what's been entrusted to them. Two of them, the five and the two talent, they take theirs and they go and they begin to look at how they can maximize what's been entrusted to them. It tells us the one with five talents goes and starts to trade with them. And even tells us he immediately does this. Like you get the sense that this servant is excited, that the master sees such value in him that says, here, I want you to have these talents. And he is grateful and he is excited about how can I now go and invest and manage and leverage and maximize these resources so that when my master comes back, he can have more of them. Then it says he makes five talents more. And so here's how I imagine this going down. I don't know if this isn't like Bible, so take this as just my own interpretation to it. I think of this person with five talents as like they are a great business person. They are great in negotiating. They are great at finding a good opportunity and good deals, and they go and find something. They leverage it, right? They use the skills and gifts that this person has, and they go and maximize that. It doesn't tell us what the two-talent person does. It just says he makes two talents more. So I imagine maybe this person is someone who's just, they're great at making things. Like maybe they're a farmer. Perhaps they're somebody who is just great at seeing something and then making more of it or being able to increase that. And so it's like he gets two more talents. He invests those things in maybe what he currently does in his business, expands it, and now doubles his output and his revenue. Right? Maybe he's able to make more of something. And so now when the master will come back later on in the story, he can sell the proceeds of that, and actually he doubles what he'd actually had in the first place. You see, to each one, they had their own abilities, their own gifts. They didn't do the same thing, but yet they saw what was given to them and says, how do I maximize this? But then you see the one talent person. And this is where the slothfulness comes in. Because did the one talent person do anything? Yes. Technically, they did. It said they looked for a place that they could go and bury their talent. And so they had to scope around their community. They had to find, where can I find a piece of land that I could dig a hole to put all this money in that hopefully nobody else finds, right? Because if somebody else stumbles across this, dug up ground and says, ooh, look at all this money. I'm going to take these talents and now they're mine. So he has to look, where's the place? And he has to go and dig a hole. Nate Bargatze, a comedian, has this bit about digging holes that is hilarious. I would look it up later. But he talks about like how hard it is to dig a big hole. Like it's just exhausting. If you've ever tried to dig and, unless it's this time of year where everything's moist and wet, right? But there's a sense of digging a hole, like there's a lot of hard work in that. He doesn't have like a, an excavator to just dig things out. Like this is by his own hands. So he's working. But where the slothfulness comes in is he doesn't see what's been entrusted to him, and he's not saying, how can I maximize this for my master? Instead, he's looking at it and saying, well, I'm afraid what we're going to find out in the text. And so he hides it. And so he doesn't actually value his master. Because remember, our efforts reveal our affections. And so as we look at what language is the behavior of these servants communicating, the two that go and double it, you see their affections. You see what that's revealing. As they're saying, I want to maximize this for my master. And the one who hides it, you see there's a sense of a lack of value. You see, here's what this text tells us, is that you can be busy in life, but you can be busy doing the wrong things. See, being slothful isn't just sitting around and being lazy. It's not just a lack of effort. But as the ancient church fathers were looking at slothfulness and why it's included in this list of vices, it's not just because it means a lack of effort, but the word that they use to talk about sloth actually can be defined as a lack of care or a lack of love. It's lacking motivation to do the right thing. So this servant took what was given to him and wasn't motivated by his love and honor and respect and admiration for his master, and instead let fear get in the way and move him towards indifference towards his master. To where we're going to see in just a moment when he comes back, he's like, here, I just wanted to give you back what was yours. You kind of see this indifference that's going on. And so maybe as you think about your life, and if I were to survey the audience here and to tell me on a scale of 1 to 10, how busy is your life? I imagine for many of you, you would say it's busy. I mean, often you say, a busy week, busy day, right? We can be so busy, but the question we've got to ask ourselves is, are we busy doing the right things? Are you busy doing the right things, pursuing the right things, leveraging your time, your talent, and your resources in the right way? And you may say, Lee, what is that? And I would say, I don't know that I could tell you that from here, but I would say that's a conversation you have to have with God about it. Because we all have different talents. We all have different abilities. We all have different resources. But the question isn't just how do I live my life being busy, but the question we got to ask ourselves is how do I live my life in such a way that I'm pursuing the right things with the right outcome with my life? Because we just have one of those. You just have one life. So how do we leverage and use those things in a way that would honor the Lord? Are we busy doing the right things? Let's see what happens in verse 19 as we look at the other servant. Or actually, we look at kind of the response when the master comes back. Verse 19, now after a long time, the master of those servants came and settled accounts with them. The master came back. And in essence, it's saying, okay, I want to see the fruit of your labor. He who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 more. Saying, Master, you delivered to me 5 talents. Here, I have made 5 more talents. His master said to him, well done. Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. And he also had 2 talents came forward saying, Master, you delivered to me 2 talents. Here, I've made 2 talents more. And his master said to him, well done. Good and faithful servants. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. You look at these faithful servants and they are commended for their faithfulness, for their diligence. And notice again, 5 talents and 2 talents. The 5, you would say, man, he is commended. Like, great job. He doubled it. Jesus did not go to the 2 talents and say, hey, why didn't you make 5? He gets the same kind of response the 2 talent does as the 5 talent does, because they were each given and trusted with resources according to their abilities. That's why we don't need to compare ourselves of, you know, how do we measure up to those around us? The question again is, how are we being successful with leveraging and managing and stewarding what God's given you and not what he's given other people? But notice the excitement of these servants. It's like he says, whenever they show up there, at the end of verse 20, he says, the one with 5 talents says, Master, you delivered to me 5 talents. Here, I have made 5 more talents. There's this excitement. And it made me think about early on in our marriage, Michelle and I, we had a cat. You have dog people and cat people. We had some cats and dogs. We were a little crazy about that. But if you've had a cat, our cat's name was Peppers. He's a unique cat. I'll have to tell you more about him another time. He eventually didn't have any teeth. Interesting story, but when he had teeth, I don't know, it's a weird picture, a cat without teeth. But anyways, this cat had teeth, and you know what cats like to do? They like to find rodents, right? They help keep your house and your area free of those little critters. But what do those cats do when they find that little mouse or find that little rodent? Where do they like to place that rodent, right? Do they like to hide it and conceal it somewhere, or do they try to put it in the most obvious place so that you can see it? The second one, right? Because they want you to see what they've done, right? They want you to see, look, I've killed this mouse. Aren't you so proud of me, right? They are just so happy about that. You're like, this is disgusting. Sometimes it's half of a mouse. It's not even a whole mouse, right? You're just like, oh, I want to get rid of this thing. But this cat is excited because it wants you to see what it's done. And I think of this with these servants. They're like, the master's like, Master, look what I have done. Like, you've given me, you've entrusted me these things, and now I've stewarded them faithfully. And here, look, I've made five more. I've doubled this for you. There's this eagerness and excitement. And then the master looks and says, well done. And I'm someone, I love words of affirmation. I love hearing, good job. And whether you are a spouse or you are, you know, your worker, employee, and with your boss, or you're an athlete, you think about like whatever it is, there's something about when somebody looks at kind of the work that you've done and they say, good job, well done. There is a sense of like you've made them proud of what you've done. There's a joy that comes from that. Now, there can be an unhealthy side to that. Don't get me wrong. But I can't imagine standing before the maker of heavens and earth, the creator, King of kings, Lord of lords, looks at your life and my life, and as you're standing there, and he says, well done. Isn't that what we're living for, that we get to the end? Not that we've got the most stuff or, you know, the most in our retirement or, you know, we've had an enjoyable life, but he looks at you and I and he says, well done, good and faithful servant. You chose what was better, good, right? The decisions, how you lived your life was good, and you were faithful. You were faithful with what was given to you. And then he says, enter into the joy of your master. You see that relationship again that they have with the master. And he's like, enter into this joy. Come and enjoy. Like, it's in essence, we're going to celebrate. We're going to party. We're going to have fun together. There's this excitement, this joyfulness, this relationship that they have. Enter into the joy of your master. You see, here's what that shows you and me. Here's what this is important. Is that love necessitates hard work. Love necessitates hard work. Because remember, our efforts reveal our affections. And so these servants were working diligently for their master. What did it reveal? They loved and honored their master. And so love necessitates hard work out of us. Think about the things in your life that you love, that you are passionate about. And then ask yourself, do those things require hard work of you? And I imagine, hands down, absolutely. If you love your spouse, significant other, if you want that healthy, does that require hard work? Absolutely. Showing up, being intentional, pursuing them, making time, making space, investing, there's hard work. Your job, let's say you're passionate about what you get to do. Does that require hard work of you? To make sacrifices, to work long hours, to put in all the hard work and the grind, but you're willing to do that because you love what you get to do. Love necessitates hard work. Think about your relationship with God. If you love him, see, sometimes we just take that one for granted. I've gotten this get out of jail free card. I prayed a prayer, gotten baptized, but we don't put in the work. You're not saved by your work, but because you were saved, you do work. Jesus didn't just save us from something. He saved us for something, to live a life of good works. And so we work at our relationship with God by spending time reading our Bibles and praying and being in community and serving, right? We put our faith in action. It works itself out from us because love necessitates hard work. And that's what we're seeing from these servants, is we're really beginning to see who they love and what they love. You see, the slothful servant, the reason why he was not motivated to work for his master, because ultimately he didn't love his master. He was afraid of his master. So maybe to think about for you in your life, a question we can ask ourselves, I heard a pastor say this once, is what does love require of me? What does love look like for you to, in whatever it is that you're doing, your relationships, your work, because of your love, ultimately for God, what would that require of you? Because love necessitates hard work. And let's look at how we finish up with the slothful servant. Verse 24. He who had received the one talent came forward saying, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid. I went and I hid your talent in the ground. Here, have what's yours. But his master answered him, You wicked and slothful servant. You knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have at least invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I should have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him, give it to him who has the 10 talents, for to everyone who has will more be given. And he will have an abundance. But the one who has not, even what he has, will be taken away. Here's where we're kind of getting what's the meaning here of this whole parable. Is Jesus is trying to tell his disciples, if you're faithful with what I've entrusted to you, no matter what that is, more will be given to you. And if you're not faithful, it will be taken from you. There is this faithfulness in how we work. You see, the slothful servant was condemned not just for his lack of effort, but for his lack of love. You see, he lacked effort because he lacked love. He wasn't motivated to work for his master because in the end, he didn't really love and honor and respect his master. He loved himself. He did what he wanted to do rather than thinking, what would my master want from me? You see, in our own lives, our lack of effort can come from a lack of love. When you look at, am I reading my Bible? And maybe to ask yourself, is my heart in love with Jesus right now that I'm wanting to spend time with him? Or am I loving something else? Is something more important to me? When I think about community and being a life group, and are we making time for that? And we would say, hey, because I love Jesus and he wants me to be in community and he modeled that for me and I want to make that a priority. And we say, well, I'm busy. I don't have time for that in my life. And it may be to ask, are we busy with the right things? What is our lack of effort communicating? What is our lack of love for Jesus showing up for? Serving, and it comes to investing and caring for those around us. We see Jesus was a servant, and he modeled that for us. And we would look at our lives and say, how am I serving those around me? And if we would say, I'm not, what is that showing? What's that communicating? Am I truly loving Jesus and how I live my life through those things? And so maybe to ask a question before we leave is, where are you lacking effort in your life? Where, as you look at in your life, and especially when it comes to your relationship with God, would you say the effort is lacking? You're just not putting in the hard work. And we would just ask, why? Why is that? And my guess is at the root of it, there's a lack of love, ultimately, for God. That the heart is loving something else. And what Jesus would want to warn you and I is what he's telling these servants is that we have one life, and he is coming back. We don't know when. It could be right now. Nope. Okay. But he's coming back. And we're going to stand before him and give an account for what we have used and managed for his. And to be able to evaluate and see, God, how have we faithfully done that? As I think about this, I couldn't help but think about this tube of toothpaste. There are like two kinds of people in the world. There's the one person who grabs a toothpaste and just squeezes it right and puts it on the toothbrush and just leaves it as this mess, you wicked and slothful servant. Then there's the other person who likes to just get every little bit out of it right, squeezes it on the edge, and then you try to get it on a nice little way. And what you end up doing is you try to use every bit of this toothpaste. See, the wicked and slothful person, they just, you know, whenever they think it's about done, they're just done with it. But man, the faithful one sits there and just tries to get every bit, right? Wants to squeeze every last. There's a whole week left in this toothpaste. We don't need to throw it away yet, right? They're trying to maximize it. It's a silly illustration. But I think about for our lives, right? How do we try to squeeze as much out of our one life to maximize for our King? How do we leverage it? How do you leverage your gifts, your talents, your abilities? How do you leverage them for God's glory, God's goodness? Instead of your own. How do we maximize that? Because we don't want to get to the end of our life and realize we've wasted it. But rather, we stand before our King and he says, well done, good and faithful servant. Because if we ask ourselves, if our efforts reveal our affections, what do we learn about Jesus? What do his efforts reveal about his affections for for you? What was he willing to do for you? It involved a cross. It involved being betrayed. It involved dying. It involved being buried. It involved being left alone in a tomb, and 3 days later, coming out, conquering your sin, conquering death, and being the one who could offer and give us hope and new life in him, so that we can now live our lives in response to his love because of what he's given to us. Let's pray together here. Heavenly Father, as I think about our lives and the one life we have, and God, how we're tempted to just squander it like the slothful servant. That, Lord, we may be slothful, not because we're not doing anything, but because, God, we're doing the wrong things. And so maybe for some of us in the room here, there's this chance for us to reflect in our own lives and to say, Lord, how can I leverage this one life for you? How do I maximize? How can my efforts and how I'm living reveal my love for you? What might that look like? And so if we've got to ask ourselves, how do we change our efforts? We have to look at how do we change our affections. And maybe that's where we start today, God. No matter where we're at in the room, that maybe the change that we need in our lives isn't about doing more or doing less, but it's about loving the right thing. Ultimately, it's about loving Jesus and what he has done for us. And as we love him, that would lead us to living our lives for him and with him. And so God, wherever we're at in the room, maybe that's the step we need to take. Is rather than getting busy doing all kinds of things, we might sit at your presence, God, reflecting on what you have done for us, that your love for us might change how we live for you, for your glory and our good. Pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.